Leviathan, Part 1, Man, by Thomas Hobbes, first published in 1651. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapters 6 and 7. Chapter 6, The Interior Beginnings of Voluntary Motions, commonly called the Passions, and the speeches by which they are expressed. There are in animals two sorts of motions that are special to them. One kind is called vital motion. It starts when the animal is generated and continues without interruption through its whole life. The circulation of the blood, the pulse, breathing, digestion, nutrition, excretion, and so on. None of which motions need any help from the imagination. The other kind is animal motion, otherwise called voluntary motion. For example, walking, speaking, moving any of our limbs in whatever manner is first imagined in our minds. I have already said that sense is motion in the organs and interior parts of a man's body, caused by the action of things that he sees, hears, etc., and that fancy is merely what remains of that same motion after sense has stopped. And because walking, speaking, and other such voluntary motions always depend on a preceding thought of where to walk to and by what route, and what to say, it is evident that the imagination is the first internal beginning of all voluntary motion, because that preceding thought occurs in the imagination, which I have said is also known as the understanding. Uneducated people don't think of any motion as occurring when the moving thing is visible, or the distance it moves is too short to be perceptible, but such motions do occur. Take a distance as short as you like. Anything that moves across a distance, including that one, has to move across that little distance itself. These small beginnings of motion inside the body of man, before they appear in walking, speaking, striking, and other visible actions, are commonly called endeavour. When this endeavour is a motion towards something that causes it, it is called appetite or desire, the latter being the general name, while the other is often restricted to hunger and thirst, that is, the desire for food and drink. And when the endeavour is away from something, it is generally called aversion. The words appetite and aversion come to us from the Latins, and they both signify motions, one of approaching, the other of withdrawing. It is interesting that those original word meanings embody truths that were lost to, or denied by, philosophers. For nature itself often presses onto men truths that they stumble over when, later, they look for something beyond nature. The schools find no actual motion in a mere desire to walk or to move. But because they have to admit that motion is somehow involved, they call it metaphorical motion, which is an absurd thing to say, because although words may be called metaphorical, bodies and motions cannot. What men desire, they are also said to love, and they are said to hate the things they have aversion for. So that desire and love are the same thing, except that by desire we always signify the absence of the desired object, whereas by love we usually signify that the object is present. So also by aversion we signify the absence of the object, and by hate its presence. Of appetites and aversions, a few are born with men. Among those few are the appetite for food, and the appetite for urination and excretion, and these would be better characterized as aversions from something they feel in their bodies. All our other appetites are for particular things, or specific kinds of things, and they come from experience, trying the effects of things on ourselves or on other people. The only desire we can have relating to things that we don't know at all, or that we believe don't yet exist, is the desire to taste and try them. But we can have aversion not only for things that we know have hurt us, but also for things which, for all we know to the contrary, may hurt us in the future. Things that we neither desire nor hate, we are said to contemn, or to regard as negligible, contempt being nothing but the heart's immobility or stubborn resistance to the action of certain things. It occurs when the heart is already moved in some other way, by objects more powerful than the contemned ones, or from lack of experience of the latter. And because the constitution of a man's body is continually altering, it is impossible that all the same things should always cause in him the same appetites and aversions, much less can all men agree in desiring the same object. Whatever is the object of any man's appetite or desire is what he calls good. The object of his hate and aversion he calls evil or bad, and the object of his contempt he calls low and inconsiderable. For the words good, evil, bad, and contemptible are always used in relation to the person using them. Nothing is simply and absolutely, i.e., just considered in itself, good or bad. There is no common rule of good and bad to be taken from the nature of the objects themselves. If you live in a commonwealth, your rules of good and bad will come from the person who represents the commonwealth, or from an arbitrator or judge whose judgment disputants agree to accept. If you don't live in a commonwealth, your rule of good and bad must come from yourself. The Latin word pulchrum signifies anything that by some apparent present signs promises good. In English, we have no such general name as that. We say of some things fair, of others beautiful or handsome or gallant or honourable or comely or amiable. The Latin word turpe signifies whatever promises evil. In English we say foul, deformed, ugly, base, nauseous, and the like, as the subject shall require. All these words in their proper places signify nothing but the look or bearing or countenance that promises good or evil. So there are three kinds of good. Good in the promise, pulchrum. Good in the effect, as the end desired, jucundum, delightful. And good as a means, utile, profitable. Similarly, on the bad side, bad in promise, turpe. Bad in effect, and as an end, molestum, unpleasant, troublesome. And bad in the means, inutile, unprofitable, hurtful. When we sense what really happens inside us is only motion caused by the action of external objects, though it appears to the sight as light and colour, to the ears as sound, to the nostrils as odour, and so on, similarly, when the effects of that same object are continued from the eyes, ears, and other organs to the heart, the real effect there is nothing but motion or endeavour, which consists in appetite towards or aversion away from the object that caused the motion. But the appearance or sense of that motion is either what we call delight or what we call trouble of mind. This motion called appetite, or delight, or pleasure, considered as an appearance, seems to strengthen and help vital motion, which is why it was appropriate for things that caused delight to be called jucunda, from helping or strengthening, and the contrary things to be called molesta, offensive, from hindering and troubling the vital motion. So pleasure or delight is the appearance or sense of good, and molestation or displeasure is the appearance or sense of bad. And consequently, all appetite, desire, and love is accompanied with some delight, more or less, and all hatred and aversion with more or less displeasure and offence. Of pleasures or delights, some arise from the sense of a present object, and those can be called pleasures of sense. Of this kind are all onerations and exonerations of the body, that is, loading food and unloading excrement, as also everything that is pleasant to see, hear, smell, taste, or touch. Other pleasures arise from the expectation that comes from foreseeing some end or consequence of things, whether those things actually please or displease our senses when they happen. These are the pleasures of the mind of the person who draws those consequences and forms the corresponding expectations, and are generally called joy. Similarly, some displeasures are in the senses, and are called pain, others in the expectation of consequences, and are called grief. Each of these simple passions, called appetite, desire, love, aversion, hate, joy, and grief, has different names for different contexts in which it occurs. When they succeed one another, they are variously labelled according to men's opinion about the likelihood of achieving their goal. They can be variously labelled in terms of the object loved or hated, or from the thought of several of them together, or from the alteration or succession itself. Appetite with an expectation of success is called hope. Appetite without such an expectation is called despair. Aversion with the opinion that hurt will come from the object, fear. Aversion with the hope of avoiding that hurt by resistance, courage. Sudden courage, anger. Constant hope, confidence in ourselves. Constant despair, diffidence about ourselves. Anger for great hurt done to someone else, when thought to be done wrongly, indignation. Desire for someone else's good, benevolence, goodwill, charity. If to man generally, good nature. Desire for riches, covetousness. A name always used to express blame, because anyone contending for riches is displeased with anyone else's getting them. Though the desire in itself ought to be blamed or not, according to the means by which riches are sought. Desire for office or rank, ambition. A name used also in the blame-expressing sense, for the reason just given for covetous. Desire for things that do little to further our ends, and fear of things that are of little hindrance. Pusillanimity or pettiness of soul. Contempt towards little helps and hindrances, magnanimity, or greatness of soul. Magnanimity in face of danger, of death or wounds, valour, fortitude. Magnanimity in the use of riches, liberality. Pusillanimity in the use of riches, wretchedness, miserableness, or parsimony, depending on whether the speaker likes or dislikes it. Love of persons for society, kindness. Love of persons only for pleasure of the senses, natural lust. Love of the same, acquired from thinking over past pleasures, luxury. Love of one person in particular, with a desire to be exclusively beloved, the passion of love. The same, with fear that the love is not returned, jealousy. Desire to hurt someone so as to make him condemn some past action of his own, revengefulness. Desire to know why and how, curiosity. This occurs in no living creature but man, so that man is distinguished from other animals not only by his reason, but also by this singular drive of curiosity. In the other animals, the appetite for food and the other pleasures of the senses push aside any concern for knowing causes. Curiosity is a lust of the mind which, because of the lastingness of delight in the continual and unresting accumulation of knowledge, surpasses the brief intensity of any carnal pleasures, such as lust of the body. Fear of invisible powers, whether privately invented or taken from stories that are publicly allowed, religion. From stories that are not allowed, superstition. And when those powers really are what we have imagined them to be, it is true religion. Fear, without knowing what one is afraid of, or why, is panic terror, so called from the fables that make Pan the author of such fears, though really, the first person in a group to experience such fear always has some notion of why, and the rest follow his example in running away, everyone supposing that the others know why. So this passion happens only to large groups of people. Joy at something new, admiration, meaning surprise or wonder, which is exclusive to man, because it excites the appetite for knowing the cause. Joy arising from imagining one's own power and ability is the exaltation of the mind called glorying. If this is based on experience of one's own former actions, it is the same as confidence. But if based on the flattery of others, or supposed by oneself only for delight in what will come of it, it is called vainglory. This is a good name for it, because a well-grounded confidence leads one to attempt things, whereas a mere supposition of power does not, and is therefore rightly called vain or pointless. The vainglory that consists in pretending or supposing we have abilities that we know we don't have occurs mostly in young men. It is nourished by the histories or fictions of heroes, and is often corrected by age and employment. Grief from believing that one lacks power is called dejection of mind. Sudden glory is the passion that causes those grimaces called laughter. It is caused either by some sudden act of the person's own that pleases him, or by his awareness of something wrong with someone else, by comparison with whom he suddenly applauds himself. This happens mostly in people who are conscious of the fewest abilities in themselves. They are forced to keep themselves in their own favour by observing the imperfections of other men. So much laughter at the defects of others is a sign of pusillanimity, small-mindedness. For one of the proper works of a great mind is to help others, and free them from scorn, and to compare itself only with the most able. On the other side, sudden dejection is the passion that causes weeping, and is caused by events that suddenly dash one's dearest hopes, or kick away some prop of one's power, and it occurs mostly with those who, like women and children, rely principally on external helps. Some weep for the loss of friends, others for their unkindness, yet others for reconciliation that puts a sudden stop to their thoughts of revenge. In all cases, both laughter and weeping are sudden motions, each taken away by the passage of time, for no man laughs at old jokes or weeps over an old calamity. Grief for the discovery of some defect in one's own abilities is shame, or the passion that reveals itself in blushing. It consists in the awareness of something dishonourable in oneself. In young men, it is a sign of the love of good reputation, and is commendable. In old men, it is a sign of the same, but is not commendable, because it comes too late. The contempt for good reputation is called impudence. Grief for the calamity of someone else is pity. It arises from the thought of a similar calamity befalling oneself, which is why it is also called compassion, and in current English, fellow-feeling. That is why the best men have the least pity for a calamity that someone has brought upon himself by his own great wickedness, and why for any given calamity the least pity will come from those who think themselves least liable to be pitied. Contempt or little regard for the calamity of others is what men call cruelty, and it comes from the person's confidence about his own good fortune. I don't think it possible that any man should take pleasure in other men's great harms without some thought of his own goals coming into it. Grief over the success of a competitor in wealth, honour, or other good, if it is combined with efforts to equal or exceed him, is called emulation. But when combined with an endeavour to trip up or hinder a competitor, it is envy. Sometimes in the mind of a man, appetites alternate with aversions, and hopes with fears, all concerning one thing. That happens when various good and bad consequences of doing or not doing the thing in question come successively into his thoughts, so that sometimes he has an appetite for it, and sometimes an aversion from it, sometimes a hope to be able to do it, and sometimes despair of success or fear to attempt it. And the whole sum of desires, aversions, hopes, and fears, continuing until the thing is either done or thought impossible, is what we call deliberation. So there is no deliberation about past things, because it is manifestly impossible for them to be changed, or about things known or thought to be impossible, because men know, or think that such deliberation is pointless. But we can deliberate about something impossible if we think it possible, because in that case we don't know that deliberation is pointless. It is still called deliberation because it is a process of putting an end to the freedom we had to do or not do according to our appetite or aversion. This alternation between appetites and aversions, between hopes and fears, occurs just as much in other living creatures as in man, and therefore beasts also deliberate. Every deliberation is said to end at the point where the thing in question is either done or thought to be impossible, because until then we are free to do or not do it according to our appetite or aversion. In deliberation, the last appetite or aversion, the one that attaches immediately to the doing or to the not doing, is what we call the will. This is the act of willing, not the faculty of willing. Beasts that deliberate must necessarily also have the faculty of willing. The schoolmen would deny this, but for an invalid reason. The schools commonly define the will as a rational appetite, but this is not a good definition. If it were sound, there could be no voluntary act against reason, for a voluntary act is simply one that proceeds from the will. But if instead of a rational appetite we say an appetite resulting from a preceding deliberation, then the definition is the same as I have just given. Will, therefore, is the last appetite in deliberating. And though in ordinary talk we may say, "He once had a will to do that, but he didn't do it," that will is strictly just an inclination, which is not enough to make an action voluntary, because the action depends not on it, but on the last inclination or appetite. This makes it obvious that voluntary actions include not only ones that come from greed, ambition, lust, or other appetites for the thing under deliberation, but also ones that come from the aversion or fear of the consequences of not doing the thing. The forms of speech through which the passions are expressed are partly the same as, and partly different from, those by which we express our thoughts. First, in general, all passions can be expressed indicatively, as in, I love, I fear, I joy, I deliberate, I will, I command. Some of them have modes of speech all their own, which are not affirmations, although they can license inferences to affirmations, inferences that come from the speech in question, but not from the passion it expresses. For example, wishes have the optative form. Would that the queen had married is not an affirmation, expresses a passion, a wish, and supports an inference to the affirmation. The queen did not marry, which is a consequence of the optative, but not of the wish it expresses. And desires have the imperative form, return the money you stole, is not an affirmation, expresses a passion, a desire, and supports an inference to the affirmation. You stole money, which is a consequence of the imperative, but not of the desire it expresses. Deliberation is expressed subjunctively, this being the right form of speech to signify suppositions and their consequences, as in, if this be done, then that will follow. This is the same as the language of reasoning, except that reasoning is conducted in general words, whereas deliberation mostly concerns particulars. The language of desire and aversion is imperative, as in, do this, and don't do that. When the person spoken to is obliged to do or not do, this is a command. Otherwise, it is a request or else advice. The language of vainglory, of indignation, pity, and revengefulness is optative, as in, if only they would make me king. To express the desire to know, there is a special form called the interrogative, as in, what is it? And, when will it? And, how is it done? And, why? Those are the only forms of speech for expressing the passions that I can find. As for cursing, swearing, reviling, and the like, they aren't speech, but merely the actions of a tongue that has acquired bad habits. These forms of speech, I repeat, are expressions or voluntary significations of our passions. But they are not certain signs that the speaker has the signified passions, because anyone is free to use any of them without having the associated passion. The best signs of a man's passions at a given time are his facial expression, how he moves his body, his actions, and our background knowledge of his aims and purposes. In deliberation, the appetites and aversions are raised by what we think will be the good or bad consequences and upshots of the action we are deliberating about, and estimating this good or bad depends on foreseeing a long chain of consequences, of which one is seldom able to see the end. But if the good in those consequences outweighs the bad, so far as a man can see, the whole chain of consequences is, as writers say, apparent good, or seeming good. And when the bad outweighs the good, so far as the man can see, the whole chain is apparent evil, or seeming evil. So the person whose experience or power of thought gives him the longest and surest view of consequences, does the best job of deliberating for himself, and, when he is willing to, of advising. Continual success in obtaining the things you want, when you want them, that is, continual prospering, is what men call happiness. I mean the kind of happiness of which we have some chance in this life. For there is no such thing as perpetual tranquillity of mind here on earth, because life itself is nothing but motion, and can never be without desire or without fear any more than it can be without sense. What kind of heavenly happiness God has ordained for those who devoutly honour him is something we can't know in advance of enjoying it, for those heavenly joys are to us now as incomprehensible as the schoolman's phrase, beatific vision, is unintelligible. The form of speech through which men signify their belief in something's goodness is praise. The form through which they signify something's power and greatness is magnifying. And for present purposes, that is enough about the passions. Chapter 7. The Ends or Resolutions of Discourse. All discourse, governed by a desire for knowledge, eventually comes to an end, either in success or in abandonment of the search. And when something interrupts a chain of discourse, there is an end of it for that time. If the discourse is merely mental, it consists of thoughts that the thing will be, won't be, or has been, hasn't been, alternately. So that wherever you break off the chain of a man's discourse, you leave him in a presumption of, it will be, or it won't be, or has been, or hasn't been. All this is opinion. And the alternation of appetites, in deliberating about good and bad, is exactly the same in shape as the alternation of opinions in inquiring into the truth about past and future. And just as the last appetite in deliberation is called the will, so the last opinion in a search for the truth about past and future is called the judgment, or firm and final sentence of the person in question. And just as the whole chain of alternating appetites in the question of good or bad is called deliberation, so the whole chain of alternating opinions in the question of true or false is called doubt. No discourse whatever can end in absolute knowledge of any past or future fact. For the knowledge of fact starts as sense, and from then on it is memory. As for the knowledge of consequences, which I have said before is called science, it is not absolute, but conditional. No man can know through discourse that this or that is or has been or will be, which is to know absolutely, but only that if this is so, so is that. If this was so, so was that. If this will be so, so will that, which is to know conditionally. Also, it is not about one thing's being consequent on another thing, but one name's being consequent on another name of the same thing. So when a discourse is put into speech, and begins with the definitions of words, proceeds by connecting these into general affirmations, and of these again into syllogisms, the end or final sum, the bottom line of the calculation, is called a conclusion. And the state of mind that it signifies is a conditional knowledge or knowledge of the consequence of words, which is commonly called science. But if such a discourse is not ultimately based on definitions, or if the definitions are not rightly joined together into syllogisms, then the end or conclusion is again opinion, namely, opinion about the truth of something said, though sometimes in absurd and senseless words with no possibility of being understood. When two or more men know one and the same fact, they are said to be conscious of it one to another, which is to know it together. And because several men in agreement are the best witnesses concerning actions by one of them or by someone else, it was, and always will be, thought a very bad act for any man to speak against his conscience, or to corrupt or force anyone else to do so, for the plea of conscience has always been heard with respectful sympathy. This word conscience came to be misused in two ways. First, men used it metaphorically, to stand for their knowledge of their own secret acts and thoughts. It's in that usage that it is rhetorically said that the conscience is a thousand witnesses. And then men, who were passionately in love with their own new opinions, however absurd, and obstinately determined to stick up for them, gave those opinions of theirs the reverenced name of conscience, apparently wanting to suggest that it would be unlawful to change them or speak against them. And so they claimed to know they are true, when the most that they know is that they think them true. When a man's discourse doesn't begin with definitions, it begins either with some other contemplation of his own, and then it is still called opinion, or with something said by someone else whose ability to know the truth, and whose honesty is not doubted by the man in question. In the latter case, the discourse is not so much about its ostensible topic as about the trusted person, and its resolution, its bottom line, is called belief and faith. Faith in the man, belief both of the man and of the truth of what he says. Thus, in belief, there are two opinions, one of what he says, the other of his virtue. To have faith in a man, or to trust a man, or to believe a man, signify the same thing, namely, the opinion that the man is truthful. But to believe what is said signifies only the opinion that what he says is true. It should be noted that the phrase, "I believe in," never occurs except in the writings of theologians. In other writings, we don't find "believe in," but rather, "I believe him," "I trust him," "I have faith in him," "I rely on him." This peculiarity in the ecclesiastical use of the word has raised many disputes about the right object of the Christian faith. By believing in, as it occurs in the creed, is meant not trust in the person, but confession and acknowledgment of the doctrine. For not only Christians, but all sorts of men do believe in God, in such a way as to regard as true everything they hear him say, whether or not they understand it. That is as much faith and trust as can possibly be had in a person, any person. They do not all believe the doctrine of the creed. From this it follows that when we believe some statement to be true, on the basis not of facts about the subject matter of the statement, or of the principles of natural reason, but of the authority and good opinion we have of the person who made the statement, then the object of our faith is the speaker, that person whom we believe in or trust in, and whose word we take, and our believing does honour to him only and not to his statement. And consequently, when we believe that the Scriptures are the word of God, having no immediate revelation from God himself, we are taking the Church's word for it. Our belief, faith, trust is just in the Church. And those who believe what a prophet tells them in the name of God, take the word of the prophet, do honour to him, and trust in him. That is also how things stand with all other history as well. For if I didn't believe everything written by historians about the glorious acts of Alexander or Caesar, I don't think the ghost of Alexander or Caesar would have any just cause to be offended. Nor would anybody else, except the historians. If Livy says that the gods once made a cow speak, and we don't believe it, that expresses our distrust, not of the gods, but of Livy. So that it is evident that whenever we believe something, for no other reason than what is drawn from the authority of men and their writings, whether or not they are sent from God, our faith is only in men. End of chapter 7.